On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. He was the boy genius who made billions, the proudly geeky face of Microsoft, who set out to put a personal computer on every desktop and his own software on every computer. Now, Bill Gates, world's richest man, has announced he'll be stepping back at Microsoft and stepping into full-time philanthropy on a grand scale. His move comes at a time when Microsoft is facing threats from all sides, when the PC era it has dominated is giving way to an internet age it has not. But love it or hate it, the Bill Gates legacy, his imprint on American technology and industry and business culture, is already deep. Up next on Point, he's 50 now, and already in the company of Rockefeller and Carnegie, we'll look at the imprint of Bill Gates. Joining me first today from San Francisco with the latest on the Bill Gates announcement is Charlie Cooper, executive editor at CNetNews.com. Charlie, thanks very much for being with us.
Nice to join you, Tom.
I want to get your thoughts on Bill Gates, but first, how's this announcement going down in the markets, in the technology world? Is this long expected? How's it being received?
Well, the immediate impact on Microsoft, on Wall Street, has been a non-event. The stock hasn't really moved much one way or the other. Within the industry itself, of course, Bill Gates is a seminal figure. His imprint on the technology industry's history is monumental. But, you know, this change has been a long time in the coming. Gates telegraphed this, 6 years ago. He turned over the CEO duties to his longtime buddy, Steve Ballmer.
Old college buddy and longtime business partner, perhaps the most successful partnership in the history of technology, you write.
Without a doubt, it has to go down as the most successful partnership in the history of high tech. So in that sense, not much of a surprise.
What's the moment that Gates' announcement finds Microsoft at, Charlie? How would you describe it? Lots of threats to its big standing here.
Well, this is a transitional moment in the company's history. Microsoft, through its own mistakes, is in a situation now where it faces many different challenges. The emergence of the open source movement and the emergence of web-based applications personified by this company called Google. Microsoft is trying to deal with a new and strange situation where the Windows monopoly that it's enjoyed for so long and has, you know, generated billions of dollars may not be the answer that takes it into the next decade.
Still, 70,000 employees, $50 billion in annual revenues, not too bad for a company that was nothing in 1975. How would you describe the, if genius is the right word, what was the genius of Bill Gates that sparked this huge story of Microsoft, and is it somehow mismatched with the new challenges?
Gates, unlike many of his peers who were present at the creation, if you will, in the late 70s and the early 80s, Gates combined both technological acumen with a business sense that was first rate. He, more than others, if you recall back in the 80s, there were other software companies that rivaled Microsoft, Lotus Development Corporation, which has since been acquired by IBM, or Borland International, run by a very charismatic French entrepreneur named Philippe Kahn. They're no longer really threats anymore. Gates was able to figure out both the technical ends as well as the business ends. Now, of course, you know, that drive, that motivation that got them into, you know, propelled them to the front of the pack also got them into trouble in the 1990s with the Justice Department and its antitrust case, if you recall.
He sounds mild-mannered, even in this announcement now, like sort of like a billionaire Mr. Rogers, but behind closed doors he's said to be really fierce with his own crew.
There is the public Bill Gates, and he, Mr. Rogers, I don't know, but you know, he's not a one given to braggadocio, but don't let the PR fool you. He is as sharp and as hard-boiled as it comes when cutting deals.
Charlie, do you think American technology, if you look out on the world of American computers and technology, might it have looked different if it had been somebody else who grabbed the horns of this thing, who wrestled it into his camp? Is it Bill Gates' technology in some sense that we live in the middle of?
to some degree, I think that that's probably true. You know, Gates has talked often about his vision, or the one that he had back founding Microsoft, of a desktop throughout, you know, everybody would have desktop computing. And by and large, that's come true, and he's forced that vision through. Of course, it's a vision where most computers run on an operating system that's sold by Microsoft.
But would that have happened anyway? Was that just a force of nature, you know, waiting? I mean, those computers weren't going to stay in big college labs forever, were they? Was that really Bill Gates who made that happen?
Well, I think that's true. You know, the history of technology is faster, smaller, cheaper. But would the industry have been transformed in the same way had, let's say, Gates not been around in IBM or Digital Equipment or some of these other one-time powerhouses been the ones to call the shots? Unclear.
And the downside of the Bill Gates legacy, Charlie, how would you describe it? A lot of money, a lot of wealth made there, a lot of technology spread, and computers certainly on desktops. Downside?
Well, I don't know if there's a downside necessarily. Critics of Microsoft have suggested that the company has used strong-arm tactics to create what they call a monoculture. That's now under challenge with the rise of open source and Linux and a resurgent Apple. So, you know, we tend to demonize some of the most successful people in the industry.
Yep.
I think, by and large, Gates's impact on technology has been very positive. And I would argue that his coming impact in philanthropy may outweigh what he's done in the tech world.
$29 billion in the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, already a lot of it going out the door and much more to go. Charlie Cooper in San Francisco, please stand by if you would. I want to welcome into our conversation Stephen Manis from Seattle, Washington, co-author of Gates, How Microsoft's Mogul Reinvented an Industry and Made Himself the Richest Man in America. He's a columnist for Forbes magazine and PC World, co-host of PC World's Digital Duo on public television. Stephen Manis, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's one of the most famous stories in modern industry, but take us back to the beginning. How did Bill Gates end up starting the giant Microsoft?
Well, you actually have to go back to his junior high school and even high school days where he was an entrepreneur. He actually had companies formed with friends of his to do programming. And this is, you know, in a day when programming meant you sat at a teletype machine
right.
and pounded stuff out and got feedback minutes later from the machine at the other end.
This was an upper-middle-class kid in, was it Cleveland?
Out here in Seattle, no.
Seattle, sorry.
Seattle, the Pacific Northwest.
Always Seattle.
Yep. He grew up here. He was an upper-middle-class kid. His father was a relatively prosperous lawyer. His mother, from whom he got a lot of his values, was a big mover and shaker in local Seattle charities and philanthropies.
We still hear him talk about United Way and the work she put into that. He went off to college, but that didn't last long. What pulled him out of there?
What pulled him out was this magical thing called the personal computer. And it didn't actually exist when he first saw it. He was wandering through Harvard Square. He was at Harvard at the time. He was a sophomore with his buddy Paul Allen,
uh-huh.
who was a couple of years ahead of him and had already left school to go take a job in programming. And they saw on the front of this magazine the purported to be the first personal computer. And it didn't exactly exist at the time, but what he and Paul decided to do was write the programming language BASIC that would run on that computer because they didn't have it yet. And essentially, because they had already built their own computer, long story, to count traffic, you know those little traffic devices that have the hoses that run across?
Right, click at each intersection if you need it.
That's it. And they actually had a little business before that to run, to develop a computer that would count the tapes that were inside those boxes back then. Well, anyway, they used the software they had developed to develop this little machine, adapted it to work on this new machine, which they had never seen, they had never touched.
Right.
This is all the software world. They had created it, a virtual machine, on Harvard's computers.
And before you know it, IBM is turning to them for software on its push into the personal computer world.
Well, what had happened was, and this is something that Gates figured out early on, was you could write something once and sell it many times. So by the time IBM came calling, Microsoft Basic was on every computer of the day, even Apple, though they called it AppleSoft, but it was Microsoft software.
And with me right now in the studio, Jason Ponton, editor-in-chief and publisher of MIT's Technology Review, former editor of the technology magazine Red Herring. Jason, thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Tom.
So, the great man theory of history, is it at work here? Would the world look the way it looks today from a technology perspective, for starters, without Bill Gates?
I don't know. People have lost billions of dollars betting against Microsoft. One of the worst decisions you can make in technology is to think you can defeat the world's largest software company. But things do seem to be changing in a strange and interesting way. Bill Gates made this bet back in the early 80s, late 70s. He wanted, as Charlie says, to put a computer onto every desktop and into every home. And he did that largely by leveraging what Microsoft calls the virtuous circle, what we might call the unvirtuous circle of owning the desktop. Now, let me explain what that means.
The software, the monopoly, the famous thing.
It's a simple idea. Nathan Myhrvold once called the $100 billion bet. And this was the idea that if you owned the operating system, every software developer in the world would have to write to the application programming interfaces, as they're called. And by doing that, it meant that anyone who wanted to run applications would have to buy Microsoft Windows. And so it went round and round and round. But that system only works well on the desktop and, by extension, with local area networks and things like that.
Right.
But by and large, Microsoft has failed to extend its monopoly onto the internet, into the world of open source applications. And if you look at the current era of technological excitement, what's sometimes called Web 2.0, it sometimes seems like Microsoft doesn't understand that at all.
I mean, you think of search now, you think of Google, you think of digital music, it's Apple and iTunes, social networking, MySpace.com. But this issue of where we are today, Charlie, was there a different path? Let's say, I don't know, it had been Steve Jobs who somehow won that early race instead of Bill Gates. I mean, are we living in the Gates mind here with his sense of ownership, monopoly, or was it kind of baked in the cake? Was this an inevitable path for technology, computer tech to take?
Well, you know, there was, even inside of Microsoft, there was a huge internal debate about which technology direction to go. Back in the 90s, there were those who said, well, Microsoft should bet everything on Windows because it's gotten us here.
Yep.
And there were others who said, no, there's this thing called the Internet. That's where we need to really move. The decision was taken to evolve all of Microsoft's products around the cash cow, which obviously was Windows. And Gates was a party to that decision, and it served them quite well until recently. And the problem, well, the future, judging from Google's success, is going to be in ad-supported or subscription-based on-demand software. Microsoft depends largely on licensed software. We'll see what happens now. As Jason said, you know, people have lost fortunes betting against Gates, but they've got their work cut out.
Stephen Manis, 1986, Microsoft goes public. Following year, you know, Gates at 31 is the youngest self-made billionaire ever. Apart from his technology vision and drive, was this somebody who was driven to be a titan of industry, the world's richest man? Was that part of his self-perception, Stephen?
I don't think he actually was pushing to be the world's richest man, but this is a business genius, as Charlie said. As savvy as he is in technology, he's 10 times more savvy in business. And one of his secrets is that he was able to hire people smarter than he was. Many leaders don't like to have the followers be, you know, potential upstarts, potentially people who can rain on your parade. Mm-hmm. He hired smart people. He likes being around smart people. And that was one of his secrets. But the other thing that's been the history of Microsoft that is important to realize is they are not, despite the fact that they say they are not an innovative company. Every product that has been a big success for them is kind of like or exactly like somebody else's product. Started with Microsoft Basic, DOS. You go through the whole thing, Windows looking like the Mac.
Fast followers, the phrase applied to Bill Gates and Microsoft, rather than cutting-edge innovators.
Yeah, and the problem there is that the Internet moves fast, and you don't always have time to come in. I mean, they did it with the browser because things were a little slower back then. But, you know, now, by the time the social networking guys are imitated, there already is something else on the plate that has to be imitated. On the other hand, they do have this amazing ability to follow and come up with something that's sort of almost as good or slightly better that they'll toss in free. Or right now, spyware, they have a pretty darn good anti-spyware program that they give away. So they've always had this ability to come in right behind the leader and give them a knockout punch. Lately, that's harder just because things move faster.
Things move faster and faster in internet time. Microsoft stock down something like 50% in the last few years, and no motion on that at the moment. Stephen, Charlie, Jason Ponton with me in the studio. Please stand by. I want to welcome our listeners in. Al's calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Al. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And my point was, as I said to another person who was screening the call, that a lot of techies and a lot of people who know much more about the industry than I do have always said that Bill Gates is the Antichrist and he's a robber baron, and he may well be. But and from the consumer standpoint, you know, I was the victim of using a lot of things like the QX10, which used other operating systems that obviously weren't Microsoft-based, and as a consumer, it was a nightmare. Lots of errors, not a lot of support systems backing them up. And
so what did Microsoft give you, Al?
And Microsoft gives me reliability, a great consumer support system, adaptability, lots of applications and application support in my business, for recreation, lots of other things which the other quote-unquote avant-garde companies never offered.
So stability as a big value add here. Let us look at that point. It's an interesting one, Al. Jason, is this part of the legacy? Bill Gates, Microsoft, maybe not avant-garde, maybe not genius in the product at every moment, but stable, predictable, the mainline thing we can all gather around. Is that part of his imprint?
I think that might be Microsoft's great imprint. You know, a few minutes ago you said that the industry would have solidified behind some kind of standard in any case. I'm not sure that's true. In technology, by and large, standards are either created by governments, by standards bodies, but that doesn't tend to happen in this country. Here we have standards if there are monopolies. And to some degree, the extraordinary business aggression of Microsoft and Bill Gates created a standard under which we could all come around. And if there hadn't been that, there would arguably have been no PC revolution or not the PC revolution we see today. So I think we have an enormous deal to thank Bill Gates for.
For that aggression to own the turf, and he always wanted it. Brett's calling from Alexandria, Virginia. Hi, Brett, you're on the air.
Hello, and good to be part of the conversation. I think if one of the commentators, one of you mentioned the importance of Bill Gates' ability to bring good people around him, and he has done that magnificently.
Yep.
But he also brought people around him who had this passion with him to control. And the idea, once they saw that the operating system was controlling things, and I believe that that's why Bill made fundamental strategic mistakes. When Netscape came out, and the first reaction was, let's create a browser and let's control that sector to make sure
right.
that nobody comes in. And in doing that, they basically missed the significance of the paradigm shift.
To the web, to the open era. Charlie Cooper, how about it? Do we have a control freak at heart here? And can Microsoft, I mean, they prospered on that. It set standards, as Jason Ponton says. But is that a chain around their leg now?
I don't think that it's control. Nobody can control the internet. You know, Microsoft was playing catch-up with Netscape, ultimately was able to catch up and surpass them, in part because it stepped over the lines, the boundaries of antitrust law. But what they're trying to do is to make themselves as relevant to the conversation as they were in the days of packaged software, and that's the big challenge. Whether or not they're controlling or not, I think the constellation of forces, if you will, in the technology world have changed, and Microsoft's being forced to change as well, and that's post-Gates going to be Steve Ballmer's biggest challenge.
Old college roommate still in there, 6 years now as CEO. Jason Ponton, how about it? Ray Ozzie also brought in from this neck of the woods in New England, going to have a big hand in software there now. Of course, he came out of Lotus Notes, his creation, and Groove Networks, which Microsoft bought. What do you think about Gates' role now? He's going to be chairman. He says he wants to, essentially says he wants to be chairman for life. Does a founder like this, with a mind like Gates' mind, really go away as an influence on the company, or is he still going to be the dominant sort of ethos maker?
I think he's going to try and go away, but you are utterly right to suggest that Bill's changing role is significant for Microsoft. You know, in Silicon Valley and in the communities that imitate it, chairman is a euphemism for semi-retirement, whether Microsoft wishes to admit it or not. And in the case of Microsoft, it really matters, because Microsoft operated under a kind of cult of personality. A gentleman called Charles Simonyi, who was the company's first chief architect, created a method of software development which even has a name. It's called Hungarian. It's named after Simonyi himself, who was born in Hungary. And in Hungarian, there are a series of program managers who manage particular product groups. And at the very center is the Meta program manager, Bill Gates. Bill Gates was unique in technology in that he had a hand in defining the specifications of every single product that moved through Microsoft for more than 30 years. That's an extraordinary role. And that's going to change. And whether or not Ray Ozzie will have the ability to champion the troops, move products along with the same degree of aggression and insight and technological acumen, I think is unlikely. Ray Ozzie was a visionary developer of products like Lotus, but he's not Bill Gates.
And they're used to Bill Gates out there. Rajan is calling from Westford, Massachusetts. Hi, Rajan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
Hi. Just one comment. I mean, this call is about Gates, and I personally think Gates was a great marketing. He had a very great marketing brain, more than a technologist brain.
Yeah.
I personally feel Microsoft, I guess, in fact, is losing its technology upper hand to a lot of other companies. I've seen that they take products developed by others, they either better it or they buy it, and they basically kill the competition. And it is very apparent with Netscape. It's very apparent with many other products that I've been using for so long. I'm a software professional myself. I use the other open source operating system in my my day-to-day working at my work. But I must admit that at home, I still have Microsoft on my desktop. That's because I want my father to use my my desktop. And, and he has made it very simple for them to use.
Right, and there's the value of being the standard. But it's not the cutting edge and never has been, as you say.
That's very true. They never were on top of it. They were never innovators. They were always following others, taking their products, ideas, including there was a recent announcement where Microsoft is going to start a service to compete with iTunes and iPod.
Yeah, they're trying to compete on all these fronts. You say maybe Gates' real genius was as a marketer. Of course, they've got some headwinds on that front now as well. There's a new, maybe you've seen this new advertising campaign out, Apple taking aim essentially at Microsoft. In the ad, we're about to hear it here, the voice of the PC is a clean-cut looking man in a suit, while the voice of the Mac is a 20-something kid in jeans.
Hello, I'm a Mac.
And I'm a PC. We've got a little network going here, and it was very easy to set up.
We speak each other's language.
We share our internet connection. There are all sorts of things we do together. Who's this now? What's...
Oh, this is that new digital camera from Japan. Just came out.
Hajimemashite.
Hajimemashite.
Yoroshiku onegaishimasu.
Wait. You speak her language?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Everything just kind of works with a Mac.
Arigato.
Ne, otaku-poku-nai?
So?
Buongiorno. Hello.
Microsoft the suit, Mac the jeans, maybe the future. Well, there's a new marketing angle. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Charlie Cooper, what about the marketing genius? Can it work if the tech genius isn't putting Microsoft in the right position out front?
If you put it that way, true, it's a problem. I think the call perhaps overstates Microsoft's inability to, with its tech chops. I think earlier, Stephen rightly noted that Microsoft has never been noted as the big innovator, but you know, in the tech industry, there's the joke that Microsoft usually gets it right on the third try.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about with Internet Explorer, with Microsoft Windows, with Windows NT, etc. What they do well is they do listen to their customers. They may not be as dazzling as, let's say, Apple Computer, but they finally do get it right. And yeah, the marketing is first rate. The bigger problem is that clip points out, you know, the security issue. You know, Gates has been turning Microsoft focus onto security. 2002 basically shut down the company's development for about a month to focus its products on getting the holes plugged. Now, since then, the Microsoft's products arguably have been getting more secure with each new release. The problem is that it's still a problem. And,
but that's a problem for everyone, really, security, right? I mean, Microsoft's not alone there.
But when you have your products, your operating system is on more than 90% of the desktop computers, and your applications are so widespread.
You're the target.
You are number one. And Microsoft is now getting into security, into the security software business. They'll be challenging folks like Symantec and McAfee. So it's still a struggle. And each week they issue so-called security patches to fix.
Oh yeah, we see them flowing out. Charlie, we've just got you for another few seconds. In a new generation, do you see Gates wannabes, or is it going to be a new cut, a new profile that leads now?
At Microsoft?
Oh no, in tech in general.
Well, I think, when Gates goes to countries like India and Vietnam, he's feted as a rock star. You know, everybody wants to be like Mike. Everybody wants to be like Bill. You know, whether or not there'll be enough Bill Gates in our lifetime, I seriously doubt it.
Well, maybe one of a kind. Charlie Cooper, executive editor at CNETnews.com. Charlie, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Here's Microsoft CEO, his old college buddy, Steve Ballmer, speaking last week in Redmond, Washington, reflecting on his time working with Bill Gates at Microsoft.
Every day for the last 26 years has been my privilege to work shoulder to shoulder with a true visionary, Bill Gates, my friend, who more than anyone else unleashed the technology revolution and who is now headed, in my opinion, to become the greatest philanthropist of all time.
Steve Ballmer, I guess he doesn't need to butter up the boss that much anymore, but still, he's the biggest shareholder talking about Bill Gates. Craig's calling from Brentwood, Tennessee. Hi, Craig, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have 2 points. One, I remember the story of the IBM and Bill Gates a little bit differently. I lived in Seattle for a number of years.
Yeah.
And the way I remembered it was that IBM really had very little interest in the personal computer. They viewed that as a home computer, and their whole marketplace and their whole focus was on the business end of the deal.
Mm-hmm.
And they had Bill Gates involved in the project, and basically it was going nowhere. And finally, Bill Gates just said, I'll take it and run with it. It became the software.
Sorry, that's just not the case. That's just not what happened.
Stephen Manis saying not that way. But, Craig, I want to turn to you on a different front, if I may. You know something about philanthropy in the Gates family, I think.
Well, yeah, I'd worked with a group that had Mary Gates as our sponsor. And
this
Mary
is Bill Gates' mother.
Right. And I can tell you, I met Bill Gates, and I can tell you that all of the Bill Gates, I don't know, maybe I don't understand him, but he isn't driven by, he's not a particularly charitable-driven kind of person. But all of that gene came from his mom and maybe his dad. His mom was just one of the best people I've ever run into.
There's kudos to the mom, a big influence in his young life, obviously, and maybe in the big philanthropy he's up to now. I want to look at that philanthropy, but Stephen Manis, just to this point that Craig's talking about, how things turned between IBM and Bill on the PC.
No, Microsoft was heavily involved in the design of the PC, but this was an IBM special project.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of a skunk's work project. They went out to do it. They founded a special team within IBM to go do this thing. And that all happened before the minute Bill got involved. They knew that they wanted Bill's BASIC. They knew that they needed an operating system. There were some things in design that Microsoft added, because one of the things that Microsoft has always had is at being at the center of the industry. Everybody's got to come to them. You want your operating system? You got to go there. So they know years ahead what everybody's doing. And back then, and possibly today, they can show somebody, hey, the other guys are doing this, you might want to consider this. But as far as a major force in the design of the PC, I mean, there were some little things, oddball little games that came with it, but no, that was not coming out of Microsoft at that point.
But Jason Ponton, the perception of the PC is kind of the heart of the matter. Was IBM prepared to see the world that way?
No, it's a wonderful story what actually happened. IBM comes up to Seattle. They say, we'd like to go and buy an operating system. You know, as we've heard, Microsoft actually didn't have an operating system, but they weren't to tell IBM that. Mm. They find one. They come back to IBM, and they say, well, we've got it. And IBM said, well, we'd like to buy it from you. And Bill, one of the great moments in technology, and a brilliant insight, says, oh, we don't want to sell it. We'll give it to you, but we'd like to keep the rights to it. And Steve Ballmer begins kicking Bill under the table, saying, what are you doing? Just go with it. Just go with it. And by doing that, they actually gathered possession of the thing that really mattered in personal computing. It wasn't the hardware, as IBM thought. Mm. It was owning the operating system, because everyone would have to work around that operating system. So if nothing else, that single moment in around 78, 79, 80, that was what began the personal computing revolution. And that was Bill Gates' great contribution inside.
Jason Ponton, editor-in-chief of MIT's Technology Review, is with us, and Stephen Manis, a columnist for Forbes magazine, PC World, and biographer of in the book Gates. Right now from Boston, we're joined by Paul Shervish. He's director of the Center on Wealth and Philanthropy at Boston College. Paul, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Give us a sense of what it means to have a philanthropist on this scale wading into your world, $29 billion. Does that change the world, or does the world dwarf even $29 billion these days?
It changes the world. The amount of money that is going to be potentially available for philanthropy over the next 3 to 5 decades is enormous. And with Bill Gates using not just his money, but his great talent, as has been described already on the program, is going to lead not only to attending to world problems, but to the first time in history seriously organizing, developing methods, implementing programs to solve world problems.
Give us some examples. Public health and education in poor countries, those are giant challenges. How does a $29 billion foundation, and I think that's now much larger than the Rockefeller Foundation, much larger than the Ford Foundation. I mean, I guess this is the biggest in the world. How does it begin to exert its influence on these massive problems, Paul?
It exerts its influence by brain power. Money and the resources in the Gates Foundation, the financial resources, are virtual resources. They need to be directed by ideas. And that has been the great benefit, the great resource at the Microsoft, and it's going to be and has been and will be even more with Gates participating more actively. It will be the hallmark of the Gates Foundation, that is, ideas that will channel the great resources that he has made available.
So they're looking to leverage research on new drugs, pharmaceuticals to fight malaria, tuberculosis, sort
meningitis, childhood vaccines.
Picking up where the drug companies don't exactly want to go. Can, at $29 billion, does Gates begin to rival the impact of national giving of countries, of the role of states in international policy?
Well, that's a good point, and he can begin to do so, especially the smaller states. You have to understand that $29 billion in assets is not what is being spent each year, and people need to understand that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about $1.6 billion this last year, and that money's going to go up. It's going to increase over time as the assets grow, and as the foundation decides that it's going to perhaps spend a greater percentage of its assets each year. But the major point that I think is important is that they collaborate with drug companies, they collaborate with governments, they collaborate with other nonprofits, and indeed they collaborate as partners with whole governments overseas. And that is the methodology that is the Gates Foundation's methodology. It is not simply to do philanthropy. It is not to give money to existing organizations so that they can carry out activities. They are attempting to leverage their money so that new programs, new directions, new ideas are being applied to old problems, and that new problems are being identified and attended to.
Jason Putten, can you see Bill Gates bringing a new mindset to that world? I mean, he's described in the Times as having a ruthless streak. I mean, in the business world, he'll turn to a colleague and dismiss ideas as stupid. Paul Shriver says he's going to mix it up in the philanthropic world with ideas. Will Gates come in, kicking over fences here, or sort of building new conceptual structures for philanthropy?
I think so. There's never been anyone in the world as rich as Bill Gates, and there's never been anyone as rich who's wished to give it all away. And there have been few people as smart as he is in business.
And he has said he essentially wants to give it all away before he passes this mortal realm.
That's right, Tom. He wants to leave his children with very little money. He wants to provide the same kind of entrepreneurial vigor and inventiveness to philanthropy that he has done to technology. And I can give one extraordinary example. Mm. In infectious diseases and in diseases like malaria, there is simply no market pool for pharmaceutical companies to develop drugs because poor people have no money.
Mm-hmm.
Working with a gentleman at Harvard called Michael Kremer, who actually occupies the Bill Gates Chair of Economics, Gates has come up with an idea called purchase agreements, which captures the best part of the marketplace to allow companies to compete for a solution while creating market pull all by himself. By agreeing to purchase the best single drug to treat a variety of diseases like malaria. He's also set himself very ambitious goals. He's asked, what would it take to provide every child in Africa with clean water?
Mm-hmm.
The answer is surprisingly small. It might cost as little as $500 million a year, and Gates is willing to spend that kind of money. So I think it's possible that Gates' influence in philanthropy could vastly outweigh anything he's achieved in technology.
And maybe big leverage with his market sense in a realm that has, of course, not had nearly as much of that as the world he's coming from. Chetan is calling from Burlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Chetan, you're on the air.
Yeah. Thanks, Tom. I'm a great fan of yours and this program. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you. What do you know?
My comment is regarding Bill Gates' $500 million contribution for fighting AIDS in India.
$500 million for AIDS in India already? That's a big whack.
Yeah, I mean, he had not yet disbursed the money, but plans are on track, and they are doing a professional review of all the non-governmental organizations. And, my comment is that when, during his visit, Bill Gates made the announcement, that was such a big news in India, and all the governmental organizations which were feeling that the government is neglecting AIDS fight in India, they were so much encouraged that, look here, this is an outsider who is recognizing that there's a problem in India and who is willing to give so much money.
And to talk about it so publicly. So here you get the sort of the technology rock star talks about AIDS and suddenly it's on the agenda in India.
Yeah, exactly. And now people are discussing about AIDS in India, how to fight. There are NGOs which are lining up programs for, getting this donation and, making some impact.
So maybe a cultural change even before the money completely hits the street. And thanks for your call. Paul, how about that? Put something in perspective for us here. He's already being discussed because of his wealth and now the philanthropy in the same breath as Rockefeller and Carnegie. Is that fair? I mean, I know their foundations are now smaller, but in their day and the philanthropy that flowed from their fortunes closer to their time, is Gates on that scale?
Gates is not on the scale of what they completed over their lifetime, but by the time he is 10 years out, 20 years out, 30 years out on this venture, he's going to be making a greater impact because he will be bringing along with him not just an industrialist here or there, but whole other groups of people in the world who have money, who are financially secure, who have solved the economic problem for themselves and their families, and will be looking for deeper purposes for which to allocate their money. So Gates will not only be a greater philanthropist in terms of impact, the Gates Foundation, but it will also bring others along with him. He is both a representative and a leader on the curve of what's happening in philanthropy today. It's becoming an ordinary activity for many people to do extraordinary things in philanthropy.
So by example, Bill and Melinda bring on Jack and Sally and maybe a whole lot of others and many more billions. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mario's calling from Boston. Hi, Mario. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for a great program. I was calling just to make a point more than anything. My wife and I are looking to upgrade our computer, and she's used to working with an Apple, and we've had a computer that had, you know, run by Microsoft, and we're going to go with a computer that has Microsoft operating system because of their philanthropy. I'd rather support someone that is putting money back in. I don't hear Apple about Apple's philanthropy they're giving or anything like that.
That is very interesting. So it's enough if it's apples and oranges, you'll go with Microsoft in this one because of the philanthropy. Stephen Manis, can you see that as becoming part of Microsoft's luster? Might there be a marketing tailwind that works for the company here?
It might, but I suspect it'll be fairly small. And right now, they don't need it. They've got 90% of the market. So incremental stuff. Charles Simone was mentioned earlier. Once said, mm-hmm. You can argue all sorts of things about what Microsoft should have done better, but most of them are rounding errors.
And the billions are big. What's it feel like in Seattle these days with this announcement out there? Is Seattle worried? We saw Boeing, of course, left Washington State basically a while back. Is Seattle worried about Microsoft post Bill Gates with his hand on the till?
No, I don't think there's much worry here, and also his charitable arm is based out here. Nobody seems to think so. It could be a problem because Bill has traditionally liked having everybody or as close to everybody as possible be out here, sort of under the control of the master, and that could conceivably change. But nobody's talked much about that. It seems that's just in the company's DNA, and he is still going to be chairman, so it's not likely that that's going to change anytime soon.
Well, the charity itself has gone through a strategic review of its priorities and has come up with, a new version of how they're going to carry out their programs. The programs are global health, global education, and global development, and this will include some activity in the United States as well as around the world. And they're planning to hire up to 450 people. I think there are around 300 now at the Gates Foundation. So there's an expansion also going on at the Gates Foundation.
So it's not the 70,000 employees of Microsoft, but it's a big, big deal in the world that Bill and Melinda Gates are stepping more deeply into. It's going to be amazing to watch. 50 years old, a lot more to come here. Paul Shervish at the Center on Wealth and Philanthropy at Boston College, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Stephen Manis, author of Gates, How Microsoft's Mogul Reinvented an Industry and Made Himself the Richest Man in America. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Jason Ponton, do you expect the world to continue to be shaped by the hand of Bill Gates in decades to come, or is he going to be a quiet philanthropist off somewhere?
It'll be continue to be shaped by Bill Gates, but increasing in the area of philanthropy.
On the other side, the Internet wails away, and we'll watch Google and a whole lot of others and Microsoft duke it out with them. That will be fascinating to watch as well. Jason Ponton, editor-in-chief and publisher of MIT's Technology Review, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's been a great pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.